Greetings and welcome to this week's episode of the Pixel Crashers Podcast, a podcast where we discuss gaming news, have fun and stuff, you know, and then argue and then ramble off on random topics. It is the 5th of October, 2019. I am Angelus DiMortio, joined once again by Lila Rose.
Yo.
And Xyphon, or Xyphon.
Yes, well, Xyphon. I am Xyphon.
And now he knows
the rest of the things.
Obviously, before the trademark strike, we're trying to avoid the trademark infringement on there. The conversations that we have before the podcast are obviously the most interesting. That's when all the really good ideas come out. And then, of course, once we get on the podcast, then, you know, we've forgotten all of it. And we have nothing more interesting to say. Have a good night, folks.
And now you know the rest of the podcast.
All right, I'm playing Elite Dangerous now.
No, let's not do that. No, we have a lot of, not a lot. We have some interesting conversations to have tonight that should be fascinating, and I'm sure we'll only have slight leering jokes to make about a lot of this. But first, we need to take a moment to just make a quick announcement on there. As many of you will probably notice, Kev is going to be taking a leave of absence from the podcast and from the party streams for a little while. He will be back, he assures you. He just needed to take care of some personal stuff, so that way everybody knows what's going on up front and everybody's not asking questions and not hearing that glorious throughout the podcast. In any case, moving on from that.
Your eardrums, thank you.
Yeah, but it's fun. Anyway.
Yeah, it is.
Moving on from that, we do have some good stories to discuss this week that should be a lot of interesting, good fun on here. The first one is probably the most triggering to all of the fanboys, the PlayStation fanboys on the face of the earth, which is something to me that just really kicks it in high gear, and that's that finally PS4 is now fully supporting crossplay. I think we've had discussions about this on the podcast in the past when discussing games like the one with the cars, Rocket League, and there was another one as well, and then also Fortnite had some weird stuff
on it for a while before it faded out.
Which one?
PUBG was a big deal on that before it faded out. Yeah. Before it got shut down by Fortnite.
Yes, I think so. There was a few of them on there. But the main thing was that everybody always had issues specifically with Sony's side of the equation, because Sony wanted to kind of keep this walled garden approach, and keep kind of people isolated to the, Sony ecosystem. Now, my question to you guys on here, because we've only seen some vague hints at crossplay being supported, and it's been only really implied that there will be crossplay between play. And I think the thing to keep in mind here is that the only thing they've implied is that there's going to be crossplay between PS4 and PS Now games. Not necessarily if you say, for example, have Destiny 2 on Steam and Destiny 2 on PlayStation. Those aren't necessarily going to be cross-play.
That's just a load of shit. That's all there is to that.
Is it?
I think so. Because that's being very... Like, that's still running their walled garden shit. That's... You have the opportunity to play on other systems only if you rent from Sony's service. If that service is available on the system you wish to play it on.
Now, do you think that will end up gatewaying into more crossplay support as time goes on if they get positive feedback from it?
Yeah, actually, I think it will. The biggest reason why is it's going to start off, they're trying to keep their walled garden, but just lower the walls, but it's still there. However, as they start bleeding more and more people in, you know, out of over that low wall, they're going to start realizing that there's no point in keeping that wall there. They're going to end up just losing money spending so much trying to keep themselves sealed in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because Microsoft is, you know, already learned that they were having that kind of problem. You notice how drastically they've opened up their options, put their shit available everywhere. I don't mean like games. I mean just software in general. Look at my Microsoft Office package. They put it on everything, and it's making them a lot of money by doing that.
Well, yeah, they've opened up a bit, and I think that's a culture shift that Microsoft has gone through specifically, because since Satya Nadella took over, he's been changing a lot of the culture of Microsoft. So people think that it has to do, you will, unfortunately in the games industry, especially gamers in particular, kind of have a bit of an insular viewpoint of things. So they think that Xbox is kind of bringing a lot of their games to PC, and so to speak, just because Sony has the stronger position. And if we were just looking at console games, that would probably make sense. If you're the underdog, so to speak, it sometimes might behoove you to play a more consumer-friendly approach and try to win the consumer through goodwill. Like, for example, GOG. You know, right? Their GOG 2.0 thing. Since they're the underdog in a lot of the distribution platforms, they're trying to play a more consumer-friendly approach to hopefully win goodwill from consumers. So people might think that that's the case with Microsoft because of that. And it would make sense. If it weren't for the fact that they are doing it in every area of their business,
it's not just that they're doing it in every area with everything. Like you look at, okay, Office is the big proponent right here. You can see Office on everything. You've got it on Android. You've got it on Apple. You've got it on iOS and OS X. So it's on both their desktop and their mobile. It's on Linux desktop, Ubuntu. It's on Windows. It is, you know, they're pushing it everywhere. So, you know, like where I suggested before about certain things, like the Epic Games exclusivity, like restricting yourself. They're just, these publishers were taking it for a quick buyout. But if you actually really want to maximize your sales, you put it every single place that it can be bought.
Yeah,
you know, that's going to max your sales right there. So you want to put a game on everything instead of just leaving it on Sony or on a Microsoft system. You put it on PC, you know, all consoles, any currently commonly used console, not just the current generation, but anything that can support your software that is in current use.
Yeah, which to me, that makes a lot of sense because that, like I said, I think that there is a good argument to be had for trying to open up your platform because, yes, it does open you up to more competition, but also at the same time, it opens you up to larger consumer bases.
It's like the PG-13 rating on movies.
Yeah.
You know, you put that PG-13 rating as the way to hit all possible audiences because you can make the movies interesting enough for adults, but hit a young enough age group to get it maximize your audience. Unlike R, which puts that restriction on there, yeah, you might be able to get some good sales on it. Yeah, Deadpool has shown otherwise, so has Logan, but really they want that PG-13 sweet spot. And this would be the same thing. Try and maximize your audience.
I can agree. What's your thoughts, Rose?
Well, I think Sony's a little on the fence right now because they realize that consumers want the crossplay, and I think they're trying to make that more of a thing. The other thing is we're getting ready to have the next generation consoles out, so I think we're going to see this more in that you can have a PlayStation 4 and a PlayStation 5 play games together, instead of being walled off like the PlayStation 3 games can't even play with the PlayStation 4 games. And there's some PlayStation 3 and 4 games that were simul-released that were on both consoles. And I think that's more what we're going to see this sorry, more of this crossplay for is their own shit and not Microsoft or Switch or any of that.
Now, do you think that it's because it's the end of the generation that they're kind of experimenting a bit more, if you will, and that's yes. why they're trying this?
Yeah. So, I definitely do.
So what do you think happens when they whenever the PS5 comes out and it's hitting its stride? Do you think that they'll go back to playing it the same way they were before? Walled garden and such?
I don't know. Only time's going to tell, but I can hope that they aren't going to. But I know reality is probably going to be a lot more disappointing.
Well, I mean, one side of the thing on there where I kind of have the question is, in general, the market appears to be kind of moving towards a more open platform as far as games go. But you have Sony on one hand doing the kind of the hardware walled garden, and then you kind of have Epic trying to build up a software walled garden, if you will. And I guess the question would be, who's got the more money to last it in the long run, right? If like the more open platforms that like Microsoft is trying to breed will survive, or if the more walled garden approach that Sony and Epic are trying to create will survive. If it's just pure money, I'd say Microsoft probably has the fortitude to go to distance.
It's right? not just money. Yeah, they've got the money. They've got a big money power, but they've also got experience on lasting through hard times.
Yeah, and lasting through fuck ups.
Yeah,
that would be included in those hard times.
Yeah,
and sometimes that can be the worst hard times.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I don't know. To me, something that's always cracked me up is that, I mean, Microsoft got their wrist slapped pretty damn hard for forcing people to have a web browser pre-installed on their Windows platform, right? And yet, you have other platforms, like you don't get a choice on what store you buy your games on PlayStation from, or what search engine that you use on your Android phone, right? So I feel like that times were different back whenever Microsoft got had their stumble in their fall. I feel like that times are a lot easier for major corporations now. Which is sadly disappointing, truthfully. I really would prefer to see more wrist slapping from a lot of the big corporations out there, but I think that's gonna happen. So I guess this question brings in here, do you think now that Sony has kind of voiced a certain level of approval of this? Do you think that another piece of the puzzle on here, right? We have the hardware platforms, if you will, or I should say in the case of PC, having a software platform to play it through. Those ones obviously need to acquiesce to crossplay, but we also have the game developers, right? Sony's got their in-house developers, but there's also like the big AAA AAA developers, Activision, EA, and Ubisoft, and so on, that previously have been reticent to take on crossplay just because it would be too much of a hassle to potentially anger Sony over something like that by throwing their weight around. Do you think that we might see them pushing a little bit more?
I think they will. Everyone will start slowly giving into this, and the reason why is you start seeing a little bit of give, and people see that, they notice that, and they push harder because they know it will give, and they'll push harder and keep doing it until everything just collapses. And this is, you know, we the consumer base actually gets what they want. It may not be the easiest way to get it, but it will work over time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think another Yeah, go ahead, Rose.
Well, it's the whole give them an inch, they'll take a mile argument, and...
Yeah, that's not wrong. Well, something else I have on here, too, is that I think some from Sony's perspective on here, and something to really keep in mind with a lot of it, is that it seems to be clear that Sony's motivation on here is that they are well aware that pretty much the track record of the last several consoles has been the dominant console takes a back seat in the next generation. For example, PS2 was the dominant console, right? And mm-hmm. then Xbox 360 was the dominant console. And then technically the Wii actually was the dominant console. So PlayStation 3 was third place in that generation.
It's not just that. There's the potential that there may be no dominant console at all because hardware may take a backseat. Granted, we are still in early stages, but we are in public release early stages of cloud gaming. So that is something I think Sony, granted, yeah, I know that that's not exactly what the PS Now is, but I think they are prepping for that potential, and crossplay is mm-hmm. a potential part of that. They're looking at like, hey, we can't be restricted by the hardware anymore because people might not let hardware restrict them at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is a point on there. Something else that I kind of always see, especially now, I've said it in the past when we've talked about Stadia, that Stadia's success largely depends and hinges on 5G deployment at the technology infrastructure, because otherwise the latency that they're reporting will largely suffer. And that's the same thing with PS Now, right? PS Now is a streaming service. It's not, I don't think they allow you to download your games as far as I'm aware. So
I don't think you can.
Yeah.
I'm up to date on specifics on Sony's variant of it.
Yeah. I was pretty certain last I heard, I know people were talking about that. I know Kev in particular had mentioned wanting to be able to download the games so that they can play them offline, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Offline in the sense of not requiring them to be live streamed from a server source. But, I mean, nowadays pretty much everybody has kind of accustomed and become normalized with a DRM check-in for a lot of games. Not necessarily that people like that very much, mind you, but that they've become accustomed to it. Between Steam and Ubisoft and your various consoles, they all require an online check-in nowadays, their DRM. So I don't see really the reason why these streaming services couldn't allow a possible download unless they're doing a thin client service like Stadia. Stadia obviously doesn't have any storage space. It's running through a Comcast or a Chromecast, excuse me.
God, I've got Chromecast. Well, depending on where you live, it might be running through a Comcast.
No.
And
depending
on where
you are,
those people.
Depending on where you are, it won't be running through Comcast because, well, nothing really runs through Comcast. Am I right? Huh?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, no, my thing is that I think, from my perspective on there, I don't really see... I see that Sony does have a bit of a concern because of the track record of the leading console taking a backseat. And I think that they're trying to slip this in as good publicity right at the end of the PS4's tenure to hopefully stoke a little consumer goodwill right before they transition to the PS5. I don't know how well that will work. But I definitely think that you're right, Siphon, that there is that serious concern of streaming services taking a forefront very soon. Maybe not this generation. It might be the generation after this one. So not the PS5, but the quote-unquote PS6, if you will.
Well, I think it might start taking off during this upcoming generation. Not after it. I think that people will, especially Microsoft, whether they set up their console well for streaming to begin with or not, they're going to implement cloud gaming onto the next generation Xbox console. And that's where you're going to start seeing it take off, is in the middle of the generation, not after it.
What do you think, Rose?
So, we saw this, and remember when Xbox said that the Xbox One was going to be all digital and was going to require always online?
It's not really what they said, but that's not really what they said. That's the over the hyperbole that kind of got spread. What they essentially said is that you could have a physical media that linked to licensing to digital media, which then you could loan to your friends and whatever, but it required a 24-hour check-in, which nowadays that's commonplace. They just did a really bad job of they did not sell it well.
But like, there was a huge pushback against just an all digital console anyways. Like, that was one of the biggest things. Even if it was hyperbole, that was a huge pushback for them.
Yeah.
So,
well, pretty much lost their generation.
This upcoming generations are probably going to be discless because, and why is my chair fucked up? Are probably going to be discless because we've had that generation where it's like, okay, now everybody's buying from the online stores. Everybody's buying from the Xbox store. Everybody's buying from the PlayStation store. So now they can get away with that. So I think they're going to, again, with what you said, it's going to take a generation for the streaming to take off. But I think, like you said, the next generation, the PS6, the Xbox 500, since Xbox doesn't know how to count, I think we're going to see that streaming. Well, I mean, that's what I think is going to happen as well. Mm-hmm. But there is a bit of precedent to suggest that it's going to happen. It just takes the consumers getting used to that technology, and then there's not the backlash.
And I think that's largely what it is. And I think that's where it's the problem that a lot of these corporations run into is they don't know how to talk to consumers anymore because, well, they largely spend most of their time deliberately trying to subvert consumers and instead just brainwash them into buying stuff through endless PR and marketing rather than finding out what the consumer actually wants. So I think that's a lot of the disconnect is that they don't know how to explain these concepts to a consumer in a way that it more or less sells the consumer on what value is this providing. Like, when the Xbox One was first announced, the idea of being able to essentially digitally share games was pretty awesome to me personally. I thought that was pretty cool. And funny enough, now with that French court case that we just discussed on the last podcast, that may actually be legally required, at least in Europe, of requiring you to be able to resell games, not just share them, but entirely resell them. I don't know how that will work on consoles. That'll be an interesting one. But I mean.
For the digital end, it's going to be difficult to implement, I think, but you technically already have the reselling with the physical shit. You just go to a GameStop and resell.
It's not going to be difficult to implement. They're just going to want to make it look like it's difficult to implement.
Yeah, the thing is it's actually super easy, because even as it is right now, for example, with Steam, if I buy a game, right, then I refund that game. Can I go and then download that game again after I've refunded it? No. They've revoked my license key. That license key can then go, as far as I understand it, I may be wrong here, but as far as I understand it, that license key can then go back into distribution and be reassigned to another person. It's just like with every other service that I deal with a lot in the corporate world, where you have software licensing. You can actually unassign and reassign licensing all the time. It's a very common practice with a lot of software. So
the catch on there is if they're doing a resell or, you know, a used sale factor, instead of just giving you money and deactivating that key and allowing it up for grabs, they'd more or less have to have a buyer lined up. Once somebody clicks to buy, deactivates yours, activates theirs. Even if they don't use that same key, they don't have to do that. They just have to make the association of you sell, they buy.
Yeah, they just have to have an account. The catch, like I said, the big one that I wasn't sure on there is very specifically, it refers to places like GOG. But that's kind of a
another thing about streaming, a good way to get it to take off is have it allow people the side-by-side demonstration, referring to Netflix. Netflix started off as DVDs.
Yep.
Then they started integrating their streaming services into that, and it was all the same service for a while. You paid for one, you got the other. And you started seeing the convenience of the streaming service, even as stunted as it was, what little availability there was, if your internet wasn't working right, all the problems that it had, it just blew their DVD rentals out of the water. That's because they showed people the convenience of it side by side. You can have this fast mail turnaround, but you can stream instantly right now. And that's, you know, helped out in, say, Microsoft. If the Xbox Scarlet, or whatever their nameology is going to be, they have, you know, say you buy a game through the Microsoft Store, you have the availability to download it onto your console and play it there, but they also give you the availability to stream it. And you can see what the differences are, like the visual quality. Say you can stream it at 4K, true 4K, where the console can only play, you know, upscaled or something like that, and you can see the differences. You know, then that will start get, you know, people will pick and choose what they want. Do they want this thing locally, or do they want it to look beautiful on over a good enough internet quality?
Yeah, I see that as being that's the major thing that I see a lot of these streaming services. Now, the angle that some of them are taking, like I said, with Google, they're taking a more thin client approach deliberately, where they are trying to make it where the hardware buy-in is super approachable, right? And that's a tactic, I think, that might be.
And they're also starting out with a zero-cost subscription on the lower tier as well.
Yeah, yeah. Which they may keep, they may not, who knows. But the thing is that with their push on there, they're trying to make it very approachable for the basic person. A person who doesn't have like space maybe for a console or a PC or whatever, hey, you just plug in your Chromecast and you have a controller and your TV. That's it. Which can appeal to a lot of people. The downside of that is that
your phone.
Yeah, or your phone. Yep. Mm-hmm. The downside to that though is that you don't really have the capability, at least on the Chromecast side of it. And the Chromecast side of it is the lowest common denominator, so that's kind of the reason why I'm kind of angling at that one specifically, is because the phone, obviously with a phone, you could download games. Even if it's a larger game, nowadays a lot of phones have hundreds of gigabytes of storage, potentially, that they could use to store games. How feasible does that get whenever you start talking about, like, new AAA games that are 60-plus gigabytes? That's like half the storage on a 128 gigabyte storage, right? So
yeah,
it's hit or miss, to say the least. But I think that so with the Stadia's approach of trying to be ultra accessible to even the most basic consumers, I think is one attempt. But I think with Microsoft's particular install base and also having a console as well that people might buy. Having the dual option of stream or download might be a little bit more feasible. Same thing with Sony. You know, if they want PS Now on the PC or on the PS5, having the stream it now or download it might be a good approach for them because of their link and having hardware that supports it.
Well, and here's another thing that I think has been getting overlooked a little bit in the streaming talk is that, well, we hit on this a little bit with the Netflix, but if we have game streams, we don't have to wait an hour or more for games to install. We don't have to worry about day one patch and we gotta download install that before we can even fucking play the game. Mm-hmm. We will be able to just play the game, because guess who's going to be taking care of those patches? Whoever our streaming service is. So they might be able to download it in 5 minutes. So, woo, you can't play your game for 5 minutes. Whereas many consumers can't download the patch fast enough and have to take an hour or more for some of those.
I do think cloud gaming will have, it may not have the huge takeoff that video streaming has gotten, but it will have a decent amount of takeoff to it. And I think it will help promote crossplay. It will help lead into that, because there's going to be a bunch of different services that work all the same way, but they just have different accounts that you've got to assign to it. So, you know, people, a lot of those games, people are going to want to play with each other, but they're going to have limited restrictions on signing into one service or another, or there's going to be possibly just enough differences that people are going to have preferences from one to another, and that may end up helping to promote crossplay.
Yeah,
I can see that. I mean, the only other angle on it there, yeah, it's crossplay. I think will be, and this is the point that you brought up before, Siphon, is that as time goes on, hardware will become less and less of the focus. Which, to be fair, on the console side of things, the hardware really hasn't been a focus, in my opinion. That's another topic entirely.
No, just the brand.
Yeah, the brand, the hardware as a brand, not the hardware as a value offering, has been, because frankly, the hardware is completely mediocre and has offered really nothing of value. People buy consoles for the games that they provide, which to me is backwards and should never be done. But with hardware falling out of prominence even more as streaming kind of becomes more and more mainstream, then we might actually see hardware completely fall out of the equation. And the, you call it the rise of the digital distribution platform as being the new console, which for PC, it kind of already is when you think about it, right? Instead of having quote unquote console wars on PC, you see distribution platform wars, GOG versus Steam versus Epic. The difference is that on PC, people can interchange them like as they change their socks, and it costs them nothing.
Socks are, it's even easier than that.
Yeah. So, I don't know how difficult it is for you to take off your socks there, buddy. But so, and in any case, though, I think that as, I think it does bring up a larger conversation of how interchangeable will these services be? Like, I can envision a future of me having a Roku-like device that effectively has PS Now, Google Stadia, EA Origin, what Origin Access, and or what is, doesn't EA have a streaming? No, Microsoft has the, I don't know. In any case, you get the point.
xCloud, I think, is what they're currently calling it.
Yeah, xCloud and all those different all those different various services, all on a singular device that you just kind of load up whatever the service of the hour is, right?
I think in some cases Microsoft should stick with their testing names, because some of those are much more awesomer. Like the Edge browser was Project Spartan, like, and it was a Spartan browser. It's pretty well stripped down, and early days of Edge were still Spartan. They should have just called it Spartan. That was great. Very descriptive.
They're getting rid of it, though.
I know. And it's becoming, it's another variant of Chromium.
Yep. And it's going to be the, I would say, probably the third best version of Chrome, behind Brave and Vivaldi. Yes, that would mean that it is better than Google Chrome, simply because not tracking everything you do.
That's why I prefer the Fox.
Fox is good. Brave is also good. Like I said, Brave.
I've just had so much experience dealing with all the different variants of Foxes, so I'm very comfortable with that one. I know how to pick it apart when I want to.
Well, that and the fact of Firefox is the only browser currently right now that supports DNS over HTTPS. Which is, if you guys haven't heard of that, by the way, I would recommend you look up into it. It's actually going to be
Cloudflare, by the way.
Hmm?
It defaults with Cloudflare.
Yeah, well, I have Cloudflare set by my router. I've bounced around
various different, common use DNSs before, but I kind of like that one. I've run into some bugs with that, but otherwise, it's a pretty damn good DNS and runs fast too when it doesn't have a bug.
And the fact is that they don't sell data. That's the big thing. So the thing,
because like Google's DNS.
Yeah. By the way, for anybody curious, all you have to do is go log into your router and change the primary and secondary DNS to 1.1.1.1. Super simple, right?
Yeah, they were smart when they jumped on that one.
Yeah, I don't know how much money they had to pay to get that IP address, but Jesus.
I don't think it was money. They jumped on it early because I think they've been running that for a long time. It just, they haven't been running as a DNS.
Yeah, I don't know. In any case, though, I think we've kind of beat the streaming thing into the horse. Yes.
That works.
People in glass houses sink ships. So, and then
even had the stutter along with it. It just lined up great. Yeah. I don't think you intended it either.
No, I 100% did. Because that's the way that that's burned in my memory. So in any case, though, I think that we've kind of discussed it on here. The big thing for people to note, an important part to consider on here, is this crossplay does appear to not truly be crossplay yet, because it seems to be between PS Now on PC and their console. So it's kind of like you're still kind of playing on a PlayStation, sort of. But like I said, it's baby steps. It is overall an improvement and a general positive for the consumer. I can't say the same for our next story. I've already been rather vocally critical about Ghost Recon Breakpoint because it is, I'm trying to think of who actually put it this way, but someone actually made the quote that it was literally the worst of all of Ubisoft's bad habits rolled into one game. Well, they also decided to roll in some of their worst PR blunders from the past into this as well, by saying that they had, for those of us that were playing in the open beta, they actually had microtransactions that you could buy in the beta. That you could buy in a beta of the game, which that to me is just. Anyway, the major
that
thing.
That didn't carry over.
Didn't carry over.
Key thing to note.
Yeah. But one of the things that you could buy is their signature pay to skip options that grant you extra currency and XP and XP boosts that we saw in Assassin's Creed Origin. Or not Origin, excuse me, Assassin's Creed Odyssey, that everybody bitched about because it is scummy as hell.
Wasn't that also in the Division 2 as well?
I don't think so, because that's a multiplayer looter game, which that's the weird thing is Breakpoint is as well. So you would think.
Yeah, usually looters are the most prominent to have pay to skip features.
Well, the thing is that whenever you have a game that a lot of the, you could say the, what's the right term I'm looking for? A lot of the capabilities that your character has plays into their level, your player level, as it were. Having the ability to advance that more quickly than others, to me, is a bit of a, it's essentially trying to say if you if you pay for that boost, then you are going to be ahead of your peers. And the whole thing of, oh, this was, that microtransaction was put in the game by accident. No, that's absolutely bullshit.
Then they also tried to do the cover up of, hey, that's in case people who start in buy the game late and they want to pay to catch up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. That's exactly what they said, which, of course, makes it very clear that what they intended originally, that they got caught on, is they intended to release the game without the microtransactions in there and then put them in after release once all the reviews were in. Which we've seen several other AAA titles do already. It's essentially they're trying to review duck, is what I kind of see it. It's a scumbag tactic. But then they can justify it as, oh, we're just going to put it in later so people joining the game late can just catch up faster.
Right.
Again, Ubisoft pulling their typical bullshit PR. And that's to say that Ghost Recon Breakpoint is a painfully average game as it is. It rolled in some of the worst looter aspects of Assassin's Creed Odyssey that drove me batshit crazy. I mean, I was even a little weird on Odyssey at points because of the fact that the game was just big, wide open emptiness. This giant open world of space where there's just scattering of stuff occasionally.
Here's another thing that gets me. They're looter. Okay, it's a looter. But you have to find special boxes to get your loot as opposed to pulling equipment off of the foes you take down.
Yeah. Something I like.
That would be the best way to do a looter.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the things that I liked about The Surge. I haven't done The Surge 2 yet. Obviously, a lot of criticism about that game. It's generally just seen as an inferior game in the Souls genre, if you will. A lot of people, you know, didn't really care for it. That's fine. But one of the things I loved about it is, do you want this weapon? Kill this guy, chop off his arm specifically, aim for his arm, wear that down, chop off his arm, and you get that weapon. You want that helmet? You aim for his head, wear down his head, and chop off his head, and take that helmet. That's something that I actually liked about the game is, I actually spent, there are certain...
I was thinking of the original Halo as a looter. Now, think about it. How do you acquire all of your equipment in the game aside from that pistol you get right off the bat that is given to you by Commander or Captain Keyes? That is the only... other than that, it's like you're picking it up off of corpses, either ones that you've killed or have been killed before you got there. You know, there's a vehicle crash and shit got scattered. That's a looter right there. That's the way to do it right. And yeah, you can have those stat variances from one weapon to another. Say it's a little bit damaged, so it's not the same stats as one to another. And you can have those looter effects where it may have a value to drop one of the same kind of weapon in favor of picking up the other one, because another one may have different wear and tear on it. So that makes sense. Obviously, there would be no leveling up effect. There's no creme de la creme. It would just be slight differences from one to another. And it could be all random and procedurally generated. So it's just a matter of take your pick on what small discrepancies you want to deal with. But you could effectively run with the starting version of whatever you pick up the first time and run with that throughout the whole game just as effectively as you could whatever the last bit you find.
Yeah.
My thing is that I'm in general, one of the things that I can't stand about looters is the whole variation of a single gun that you run.
Now, that's one thing Warframe did right.
Yeah. Well, Warframe, obviously, you don't really have...
have too many guns.
Yeah, I mean, they've got tons of guns all over the place. And that's its own...
They've got more than enough. They've got too many guns even for the Matrix.
Right. I need lots of guns. No, but my thing is that, so one of the things I was vocally critical about with Dragon Age Inquisition was whenever late in the development cycle, they went and added in low level variants of the like legendary super unique items. So there were a set of like, I can't remember what the quality was called. We'll call it whatever legendary or whatever your highest tier of rarity is in that game. Mm. Whatever it's called.
Super ultra BFC rare.
I think it was artifact or unique or whatever. Point is, Those were, there was one, now you could get multiples of the drops, which is another complaint I had about that game, in Mass Effect's multiplayer, obviously, as you got card drops in the loot box gambling, that would level up the gun, and then once that gun was maxed out, it was removed from the drop table. In Dragon Age Inquisition, you could just get duplicates of the same weapon of slightly varying stats. That was annoying enough, but then later on they went back and added in more low-level versions of it so that people getting lower-level drops could also experience those. Like, no, that's, you're just adding in more shit. More dross into the mixture, if you will. That's the problem I have with looters in general, is the fact that, oh, hey, I got this awesome sniper rifle. And the weird thing about Breakpoint that I notice is, like, I had the first fucking DMR I got, and I'm taking out the level 60-some... When you're doing the introduction segment, right, and you're up against, the, like, essentially, they don't, I don't think, intend for you to kill these guys. I think it's... Yeah, I think it's intended for you to run away from those really powerful guys that, after that cutscene where you're introduced to the antagonist of the game, you know, I think it's intended for you to run away from those tough guys. Well, me being me, I sit there and play guerrilla warfare, and I take them out one at a time very carefully, and strategically with, it was a DMR or a sniper rifle, one of the two that I had acquired, up to that point, and it was like, what's a more damaging sniper rifle going to do if I'm already able to kill these extremely strong guys? And then, obviously, later on, we ran into the drones that I think it was Rose and I don't think you were with us at that point, Zyphon, but we were trying to take out some drones, and they're bullet spongy as hell. But
you mean the well-armored ones that you blew up? You drove the car into and immediately got us killed, and then you were like, well, we can't let that stand. We gotta keep going back, and...
We won.
Yeah. Thanks to me having a rocket launcher.
Yeah.
Rocket launcher, fix it up.
Well, my major thing on there is that it's a... Overall, I think that it does depreciate the usefulness of having those increasing damage numbers on the weapons whenever the enemies, even stronger enemies, still, which I think it's good that I could take down guys that are extremely powerful, because that's signature Tom Clancy, right? Yeah, even if they're super, yeah, super awesome guys, if I get a headshot, they go down. This isn't The Division. This is Ghost Recon. I appreciate that. But it does kind of clash with you wanting to make the game a looter. And the problem is that it's... The other thing, too, that I don't really know how this works. The skips part, the XP boosters and all that skill point bundles and all that shit, if that ties into the PvP elements of the game, because... It does have the Ghost War side that I always ignore, because I, you know me, like PvP. If that translates over to the PvP side of it, that seems a little pay to win. I mean,
now they did say that if you do enter that PvP realm, everybody's levels are synced up, so everybody should be on a level playing field. I don't necessarily believe Ubisoft, but I don't have any reason not to believe Ubisoft with that.
But I also do recall reading that you can literally buy pretty much every item in the game for currency, for real money. So, like, oh, I come in to PvP as being a complete noob, with basic assault rifle, basic pistol, or whatever. And I don't play Ghost Wars, so I don't know the way that it plays to speak to this. But if it's a, you can have a character that has a pre-built loadout, whatever that may be, if I go and I buy really good high-end guns and ammo, whereas somebody who doesn't have free expendable income goes in there with basic equipment, I am going to have an advantage. Yes, there is still skill involved, and you could still kill me if you were more skilled than me, but I still have an unfair advantage just because I paid. That is basics of pay to win. That's the reason why Ghost Recon Phantoms failed, is because it was, as much as I loved that game, even though it was PvP, I loved that game, but it was pay to win, and I am under no delusions of that. I didn't pay to win, which is why I lost a lot in that game. I still love the concept, I love the styling of it, but it was pay to win. And I hope that's not what they intend to do on this one, because that's going to turn into a shit show really damn quick.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, do you guys think that Ubisoft is ever going to make a single player game again?
I wish.
We all know that the next Ghost Recon game is going to be Assassin's Creed game is going to be Assassin's Creed the Loot Grind Simulator, that you can play with your friends, because it's too boring to grind loot by yourself.
I mean, I don't think they're going to, just because it's easier to make a game that can't be pirated, and after all, Ubisoft says all us PC gamers are pirates.
Right.
It's easier to make a game that can't be pirated by making it an MMO-ish game. Now, granted, Cheat Happens already has a trainer out that can force Breakpoint into being an offline only. Not saying go out and cheat, but just putting that out there, which means there is a chance that we are going to see, we might see this game get cracked and thus be piratable if it's possible. But
it's always possible.
Harder. Right, it's always possible, but a game like Elite Dangerous can't be pirated, because if you guys remember when you had to sign up, you had to create an account, you had to give the CD code and all of that. So that's an unpiratable game right there. And I think Ubisoft is going to try and go to that route because they want to make it impossible to pirate.
I largely think that you're right on the money there. I think that is pretty much exactly why they are making these games of this sort. Even if they're doing an offline single player game like Assassin's Creed Odyssey, right? That was a single player offline game. As far as I'm aware, no multiplayer parts of that at all. However, it's got all of these, not multiplayer, but we'll call them online elements, where you've got picture sharing, where other players have shared pictures of certain, certain scenic sites that they saw, or, you know, things like that. Or Shadow of War is another example of that, where you have the online vendetta missions that I keep seeing pop up and I ignore every time I'm playing that game, where, this player got killed by this orc. Don't you want to go and, like, revenge them or fucking whatever? Shit's boring as hell to me, but those little online elements allow them to justify having an always online connection, which then makes it difficult for it to pirate.
Yep.
But don't worry, Denuvo will be cracked in about a week after the game launches.
Not recently, because getting off topic, Borderlands 3 is as of yet uncracked at 23 days.
Interesting. Someone tagged me in a post recently, and I can't remember exactly what it is, but it sounded like that somebody was getting close to that. So
they might be getting close, but it's still not out right now. So it has been more than a week, and we might have a semi-uncrackable de novo, because if I was reading what the crackers were putting out, is that it is essentially in a VM right now. Denuvo is running it in a VM.
Well,
really weird shit.
Yeah, well, no, that makes perfect sense. That's a smart way to do it. However, you ask any of the exploiters that attend, like your hackathons that you have, your Black Hat conferences, one of the big the big things right now is, like, for example, with Chrome, is having applications escape their virtualized containers. That's a big thing right now in the security world, right? So it is not impossible to break out of software initialized VMs. Now, breaking out of a hardware initialized VM, like, for example, if you're running a Hyper-V server or VMware or something like that, those are a little bit different. You have an entirely containerized software.
The only exception to potentially being able to break out of those is if somebody's running the virtual machine software with bare metal pass through to the CPU.
Yeah.
That's about it.
That's the thing, is that is running, that is something that is hard to do for a video game outside of, I would say, probably very specifically Microsoft's Windows Store games, because they're not running Win32 applications. And I think that's the kind of the catch on there, right? Is that if you are running UWP applications, those are running in a specific type of container that is inaccessible from typical means of cracking. Like, there's no EXE.
It's inaccessible from typical means of fucking anything. I know, I've dealt with this before, trying to shortcut it to Steam.
Yeah. Yep. You can't really do anything with it. And it's kind of it is obnoxious in its own way. But it is also, one of the nice things about it is that works both ways. Yes, you can't fuck with it. And yes, that sucks for modders, for example. But that also makes it very difficult for malware to be injected into your computer from that. So,
yeah, there is an upside to that.
Yeah,
there is a slight upside. I don't think it justifies doing that. And that's one of the reasons why I don't really buy anything off of the Windows stores, because I want to mod my games, and they don't. You can't mod those games. There's nothing you can do. So,
yeah.
I mean, it is what it is. But my last kind of point that I wanted to bring up on here is that with, and this is something that I did talk about, but I didn't want to overshadow this, is that, do you think that there may end up being an actual legitimate lawsuit against one of these publishers or developers in the future for hiding microtransactions at launch in order to get good reviews, but then releasing them in a game later on after the fact?
That's a tough one. This goes into what I desire, but reality probably is going to disappoint me. But I would like to say I want them to be sued, because to me it's false advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Because they usually launch and say, hey, no microtransactions, hey, come and play our game. And then they throw it in, like you said, a month later, and suddenly it's got a fuck ton of microtransactions. I don't like that.
Yep.
But with the way the tech industry currently is, like, we aren't seeing any governmental step in, so why should we even assume or expect there to be any lawsuits is beyond me. And if users do a class action lawsuit, it's going to have to be within the EULA, which right now they've been going to that arbiter-based bullshit and making it so that you waive your right to a class action lawsuit.
Force arbitration. So here's the thing,
yeah,
is that in some cases, depending on the court that you sue in, and class action lawyers know which ones to go at, They'll mm-hmm. they'll base their class action lawsuits out of certain cities in order to, because they know the judges that are favorable to this. But in a lot of courts, EULAs that force arbitration are not only are they getting thrown out very frequently, or in general, undue burdensome terms in a even a partnership agreement. Like, for example, with a there was the one scumbag guy that did the CSGO lottery thing, suing mm-hmm. Twitch for banning his account, and Twitch had in their partner agreement with the Twitch partners, there's a stipulation, at least in his agreement, that said that you can't sue Twitch for more than $50,000. Which, for anybody who's aware of how the legal system works, that won't even cover legal fees. So it more or less makes it financially untenable for anybody to even sue Twitch.
The legal system only has a restriction on minimums, and that is specifically what the Sixth Amendment, when for the minimum of $20 allowing you to have a jury trial on a civil suit.
Yeah.
That is the only thing that the court, that the judicial system restricts on lawsuits as far as monetary caps.
Yeah, well, the thing is this is in the partnership agreement that you sign. It's a contract that you signed to be a Twitch partner. Well, in a recent court thing, the judge outright threw that out and said, that makes zero sense. And in fact, the that being in the contract posed an undue legal burden on a partner, because a partner is a regular average person in most majority of cases. Whereas Twitch employs a full legal team of experts to draft up these partner agreements, which places an undue legal burden on a partner, you know, without them having to employ their own legal team in order to read through the contract. And usually you don't have the option to go back to, you know, maybe if you're like Ninja or PewDiePie or somebody who's in a huge name like that can go back to Twitch and say, yeah, we don't want this, this, and this item in our contract, or else we're not signing. Yeah, Twitch will probably, you know, work through that and coordinate with them because they are big names that bring a lot of
apparently traffic. They don't even do that there, because that was part of the mm-hmm. Ninja shift, is Twitch was just, you know, giving them the cold shoulder.
There's more to it than that. But yeah, the thing is that in the case of, you know, just your average, like most partners just getting into their partnership agreement, they can't go back to Twitch and say, oh, we don't want this in the contract. Then Twitch will be like, cool, well, I guess you're not going to be a partner. They entirely hold the keys to yeah. the kingdom. And that's, that to me, and that's why a court sees that as being an undue legal burden. That can be the similar thing with forced arbitration. If a judge sees the forced arbitration clause as being an undue legal burden, especially when it comes to consumer protection thwarting, like if you're essentially thwarting class action lawsuits based upon consumer protection laws, a lot of judges are going to throw that out. Like they won't even do it. And there's even like a lot of, I can't remember what's happening to this, but I'm pretty certain there's even a law in Congress that is trying to ban forced arbitration clauses, because they are just directly anti-consumer. Like, yes, mm-hmm. in some cases they can actually be beneficial, because if I'm just looking for a refund, like I just want a game, I want to refund my purchase and the company won't let me refund it, and then I'm going to, because like let's say they add loot boxes in after the fact, right? For example, Steam's bullshit return policies, this is complete nonsense. You play the game for 2 hours, you can no longer return the game. It gets auto-rejected, right? And then the company adds in microtransactions later. I want a fucking refund. I did not buy this game with microtransactions in it. That's pulling a bait and switch. A classic anti-consumer that goes against the law, right? However, if I were to go to Steam and say I want a refund, they'd be like, hey, you played for 2 hours. Sorry, no refund. Well, then I could bring legal action against Valve or against the publisher of the game or whoever, and say,
or all the above.
And say,
yeah,
hey, I want a refund of this game. And they could say, hey, arbitration. And I could be like, cool. That could be a very quick way, because in those forced arbitration clauses, almost always the company that has that agreement will say, we'll pay for the arbitrator. And most people think, oh, well, that means that they'll hire an arbitrator that is preferential to them. Actually, they're not allowed to do that. It has to be a kind of a 1-800 arbitrators thing. They don't get to choose the arbitrator. It's just a randomly selected arbitrator that they pay for. And the reason why they do it,
people equate it too much to lawyers that these companies have on tap, but that's not what arbitrators are. They're more or less like mercenary judges is the way to think of them.
Yeah. They're not always quite to the level of judges. Either
currently or have worked in the judicial system.
Yeah. Well, no, they always have. They're usually veteran lawyers. They're not quite to judge status always. Sometimes they might be retired judges, but most of the time they're retired lawyers that, you know, they know the laws very well. And what they allow for is a much lower cost legal proceeding to just get shit done fast and cheap. You know, oh, you just want a $60 refund on the game, and you'll walk in there. And the way they look at it like this is an arbitrator might cost $500 for the company, right? Which, sounds expensive. But you say, oh, $60 refund on the game, $500, $560 total cost to the company for that arbitration versus hundreds of thousands of dollars taking something to court over that, plus a potential settlement that could be hundreds of thousands of dollars more. Arbitration is just infinitely cheaper for the company. And they can just give the people what they want, give you your $60 refund, get you the fuck out the door, you're done, things are solved. That's where arbitration is nice. Where it's not nice is it doesn't allow consumers a recourse to punish companies, essentially tricking consumers. Like, that's one thing about class action lawsuits is usually consumers don't really get a whole lot out of class action lawsuits. Like, for example, the Equifax thing that happened. The people are getting shit. And like, the individual person is getting nothing from those settlements, right? However, what it did do was it did give a nice, firm slap on the wrist to Equifax in the sense that they had to pay hundreds of millions of dollars, like $500 million or something like that, in damages. Yeah, the individual person didn't get a whole lot. Yeah, the law firm definitely made out like a bandit on that because they took 33% of that whole earnings. So they definitely made a lot. But the big thing it did was it's a good way to give a good slap on the wrist and let companies know that they can't just do whatever the fuck they want. Consumers have a way to bring action against them for acting against consumers.
I might be wrong on this, but doesn't binding arbitration not have an option for appeal as well?
I'm pretty certain it does not.
You're right.
Yes. Yeah,
so that's another thing. That one is also a double-edged sword, though, because right to appeal means that if that settlement is not necessarily ethical, does not work out for you, that's it, you're done. Yeah. However, it also keeps the company with lots of money from dragging it through court for decades on appeals.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, which is something else that often does happen when you're dealing with class actions against major, like, for example, a good example is it's not always against class action lawsuits. Usually those
appeals... It can be government lawsuits, because governments can sue companies as well, like in the case of France suing Valve over their refund policy that we discussed in the last podcast. Well, Valve is currently appealing that.
Yes. So most of the time, because essentially the catch is that most civil lawsuits in general, like the vast majority of them, are settled out of court. And what that means is essentially the defendant agrees to pay the plaintiff, sweep everything under the rug, everybody washes their hands and walks away. Rarely do civil lawsuits, like civil court proceedings, actually go to trial. Because that alone is long and expensive. It can drag out for years by itself, not counting appeals. However, the catch on those ones is that most often civil trials are very hard to appeal and usually get batted down pretty quickly in most cases, because whenever something is ruled on by a jury trial, unless there was clear legal malfeasance of some sort, usually most judges are going to be like, hey, man, a jury of your peers said that you were guilty. I'm not touching that. But whenever it's a panel of judges, like, for example, you go to a district, circuit court of appeals, and they turn you down, and you're like, well, I'm just going to go to the next circuit up or whatever, or go to the Supreme Court or whatever, that can happen because it wasn't a jury of peers that awarded that. If it's a government ruling like with France, I don't think that went to trial. I think that was ruled by a judge, which means,
yes, I believe that's correct.
Very common to appeal that because I don't think there was any jury trial involved. Jury trials are a lot longer and a lot more expensive than a panel judge ruling. And that's kind of, I think, what's where you see the difference. And arbitration, yes, is cheaper and all that. But yeah, you can't appeal that no matter what. So, obviously not a lawyer, so I could be speaking out of my ass about any of this. This is random stuff that I remember, and I think I know what I'm talking about.
That's why I specified binding arbitration, because that one, if I remember right, is not appealable. But I don't think that's the only kind of arbitration that you can end up dealing with. Binding, that is the most common kind, because that means that that's trying to finalize everything and just get it over with and be done with it for good.
Binding arbitration is largely the official name for forced arbitration. Forced arbitration is used because the name sounds a little bit more salacious, if you will, when you say you're forcing someone into arbitration, whereas the technical term is binding arbitration because the decision is legally binding. Whoever it's in favor of, that's whatever, it is legally binding and cannot be overturned.
To legal speak, I look at the difference of force versus binding. Is binding is the results, whereas forced is leading to.
I think that if you're going to have arbitration, it's going to be binding. Otherwise, what's the point? Because if the arbiter, we've been saying arbitrator. Good God, making up random words. If the arbiter
wordified,
or is it arbitrator? You know what? I don't know. Arbiter. Okay, if the arbiter makes the ruling that the company has to pay the consumer $500. As the ruling, if it's not binding, then the company can say, cool, and then walk out and never pay a damn thing because it wasn't binding. So I'm pretty certain all arbitration is going to be legally binding on some level. Whether or not it's legally binding outside the U.S., or if it's in the EU, maybe it's not binding in the U.S., vice versa. But I'm pretty certain it's pretty standardly binding. Could be worse.
It's not arbiter, it's judge, judgy, make judgment.
Speaking of shit...
Judgerson? I don't know, whatever you want to go with on that.
Speaking of shit that just really makes your eyes roll, let's talk about frogwares, shall we? So, many of you guys might be familiar with the Sherlock Holmes games that were on Steam. They were made by a Ukrainian studio called Frogwares, which it actually, they're very well regarded games. A lot of people really like those Sherlock Holmes games. Well, essentially the contract between Frogwares and their publisher, Focus Home, the publisher for that game, because as far as I know, as I was talking to Rose on Twitter earlier, there's the first party versus third party interaction. Essentially third party, you could see it as freelance development, right? And essentially Focus Home freelance hired Frogwares to develop those Sherlock Holmes games. Well, that contract, whatever the publishing contract ended on whatever means. And essentially, Focus Home just had a policy where when the contract ended, they stopped selling the games, period. And so they just pulled them off of Steam with little to no, like, warning to consumers at all. It was just like, hey, they're gone now. Well, essentially, Frogwares posted up a tweet with a note essentially explaining the situation, saying, yeah, we had no say in this. It just, you know, was done without our consent or without any discussion to us whatsoever. And, you know, we pretty much lose a whole bunch of stuff on this. And as I explained to Rose as well, the big key on this one is that the way freelance development works is usually the publisher gives money to the developer up front to make the game. So that way they can pay the bills, they can keep the lights on, etc. Then once the game launches, the percentage of the sales that would normally go to the developer, the publisher keeps until that front or that loan is paid back. Then once the loan is paid back, then essentially the developer gets their full cut of the sales. That it may not be their entire cut of the sales gets it. You know, say it's a 50-50 split normally. Maybe it's a 70-30 split until they pay back their loan and then they get 50-50, whatever. Mm-hmm. Since these games have been out for a long time, it stands to reason that kind of loan that the publisher gave to Frogwares has been paid off, which means every sale Frogwares was making their full cut on, which is something where all developers want to be at. They want to keep getting those sales because they make more per sale for those games. Well, whenever they randomly get taken down because Focus Home has a policy of not transferring titles belonging to developers that no longer have any business with them, it just kind of fucks over the developer, right?
Yeah, it screws over everyone, yep. Honestly.
Yeah.
But it screws over consumers, developer, and publisher. Like, that's bad lawyering right there. Somebody didn't read their contracts right, I'm guessing, or they just, like, were so desperate to sign that they're like, yeah, well, I guess we'll just eat it.
Well, the other interesting part about this is, as far as I understand the way the contract's written, Frogwares owns the IP. That is what they said. As the creators and the IP owners of those games, we have no control or say in this. How did that even make any sense?
There was some condition in the contract that they were not paying attention to because it gave them rights to the IP, but did not give them rights to that particular created content. I don't know. I need to see the contract, and even then, I'm not a lawyer, so I will probably miss it. But I'm guessing that there's something in there, some little nitty-gritty in there that says that, hey, you know, these particular portions of this IP is owned by the development studio, whereas it's not even owned by the development studio. Reverts to the developer's control on termination of a contract. You know, something along those lines. There, even though they have the IP, that means they have creative rights. They can continue on with the series, but those portions that have been created independently, they do not have full ownership of those.
Well, from what I understand, specifically what the kind of the specifics of it that they said is that essentially the deal with Focus Home Interactive ended, but the Focus Home Interactive refused to transfer the rights of the store listings to Frogwares. So it's not that they couldn't go and create new store listings of it, but that comes up with its own problems. And I think they're currently, as it is, they might have already done it since it's obviously been a few days. It was the 26th of September. So obviously it's been about a week or so. So they may have already created store listings for it now. But one of the things that it does is that it removes visibility. It's kind of like a YouTube channel, for example, right? Just because I'm signed up with an MCM, which you really shouldn't do in 2019. They're worthless anymore. But say I'm signed up with an MCN, a multi-channel network, right? And they have some kind of, like, the way the contract works is they have some kind of creative control over my channel. And my contract with them ends, and I want to get out from underneath that MCN. And they pretty much say, that's cool, yeah, you can retain all rights to your videos, but we're going to shut down your YouTube channel. Yes, I can create a new YouTube channel. I can upload all of my old videos that I had on that old video YouTube channel and have them all there, and bam, they're the same as they were before.
However, all of that traffic is lost.
Yes, yep. Exactly. And that's
okay, so that's what the deal is. I was already misreading just an article. So if I actually saw the contract, I'd screw that up more.
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing, is that, like, all of the people that had the game on their wish list, maybe they had it on their wish list a long time ago and, you know, don't necessarily remember the game, but when it goes on sale, they get notified and so on. And there's, mm-hmm. in a lot of cases, that sort of thing really can hurt the sales of a game, because not everybody always remembers the games they put on their wish list, especially if it was, say, during a Steam sale, whenever it was like, hey, add a bunch of games to your wish list, guys. That, you know, it really does kind of kill a game's momentum and being able to be visible, which, especially on Steam, is already hard enough, right? So it's kind of an unfortunate thing that nobody thought about this, and they just more or less said, oh, your contract's done, we're going to pull it off of there. I guess the question that I raise on here is, if the developer retains ownership of the IP per contract with a publisher, do you think that they should at any point in time allow the publisher to control the store listings of the game?
If the developer owns rights, no, absolutely. But this was a reverse case, wasn't it, where the developer had control over the store listing, or there was some effect in the store listing in which the publisher had to pull the store listing.
Well, so from what it seems like...
Or did I read this backwards? Like, the developer more or less took their ball and went home, whereas the publisher was left...
No. Frogwares is the developer. Focus Home is the... Yeah. So in this particular case, in my thought... on the way it works now, at least my rudimentary understanding of the business side of it on how everything works, is that essentially the publisher maintains for example, on Steam, which this mirrors to other storefronts as well, but they'll maintain you could kind of see it as a stall in a flea market, right? You know, you see a flea market, everybody's got their little tent, their little table set up. That's maintained by the publisher. And then the products that they sell, they rarely make themselves, right? It's usually somebody else made that and they're just selling them, right? So in this particular case, you see that stall at a flea market, and you see a bunch of video games on that table there available for sale. And in this case, it was all of Focus Home's offerings. But the deal, the sales contract with Frogwares expired, and so they simply took all of Frogwares stuff off of their table. They still have all of their other games still on that table at that flea market, but that's it. Nothing else, right? So what it seems to be like in that case is that if I were Frogwares in their situations, I would have, what they're doing right now is they're setting up their own stall at the flea market so they can sell their games, which my thought is it might have been smart to do that from the start if they retained ownership of the IP, but I don't know what benefit there is to having your game for sale through a publisher's store listings versus your own. That's kind of...
That may have been just part of the contract with the publisher to require that.
That's true. Yeah. That would make sense. So that way...
Mm-hmm.
That way, the publisher can get their name slapped all over and say, "Hey, you know, this we did something with this."
With that, Rose.
I really don't know how to feel about this. It's like I could see a little bit of arguments from both sides, but without spending a week researching this, looking at some precedents, looking at maybe a sample of the contract, I don't know. I do agree that it sucks for the dev in that they're being shafted. They're being bent over and not even given a courtesy spit here.
The truth is that I think the reason for the way it's set up currently is because the way the cash flow works, and this is something that's often misrepresented by the likes of Tim Sweeney, the way the cash flow works is when you buy the game, the cash goes through the distributor to the publisher and then is divvied up to the developer, right? So, for example, you buy a game on Steam. Steam takes the money, removes their cut, gives the remainder to the publisher. The publisher then takes their cut and hands the rest of it to the developer. And I think that's the key on there is that if it was the other way around, if Frogwares maintained their own storefront with the games, then the money would come to the developer, and then they would have to pay out a cut to the publisher, which is currently not, as far as I'm aware, the way I understand it, is not the way that it's handled. So,
well, part of the whole publishing idea is, you know, you create the work of art, the publishing company makes it public for you.
Yeah, they're responsible for the administration side of it.
It's not just the administration, it's the making it public. That's the whole idea of publishing, having a publishing company. Well, they make it public for you.
Yeah, I mean that as the classic role of a publisher. You take it from books to movies to, you know, whatever. The classic role of a publisher is the creative person makes the product. The publisher handles all of the nuts and bolts of getting it into other people's hands and making money for the creative person. You know, as I call it, administrative, but really it's the sales, if you will.
Logistics.
Logistics, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Which the thing is that in the games industry, traditionally that was their responsibilities were the distribution and sale of the game, right? They were responsible for maintaining
order stores.
Well, because at the time, early on in video games histories, the production of discs was actually fairly expensive at one point in time, or cartridges for that matter. So having a publisher to just operate their own disc production factories or contracting disc production factories, right? And then the developer develops the game, hands a gold copy, you know, the going gold, if you will, the master copy of the game, hands it off to the publisher. The publisher goes and makes thousands of copies of that master and distributes it out to various outlets and stores for purchase, right? Obviously,
same way it would work for a book.
As a book or music or movies or whatever, this is a very similar process, right? That's the kind of the traditional way that a publisher operates, which it's kind of gotten a little bit more complicated with both fronts, movies. Oh, hell, actually, movies, books, all of it nowadays, because you have digital distributors like Amazon for books, like, Amazon Books or Audible or whatever, or Steam or Netflix, whatever. You have an additional layer, distribution layer in that chain that gets added in there as well. So previously, where it was just the publisher, now you have publisher and distributor as two separate entities, which is a little weird, but that's where the complexity gets added in here is when you have the distributor or the publisher working with a distributor and the publisher then pulling the developer's games off without contacting the developer. That's where I kind of have a problem with it.
Yeah.
Even if they just let them know and said, hey, we're gonna pull your games off here.
You have 30 days to pack your bags. We already changed the locks on you.
Yeah, as far as I understand from what they said is that they didn't even, it sounds like they did barely said anything. Maybe they gave them an announcement as they were doing it. You know, and as far as what Frogware says, that there was no policy of doing that ever mentioned to them in any of its contracts with the publisher and had not been applied to Frogwares in the past. So it seems like a priori after the fact. I can't remember my terms here on here. But essentially it's a retroactive change to contract, which is legally not allowed when you're dealing with a contract. You can't just go and add shit on after the fact. That's not the way those work. Strangely, I'm not sure why they didn't make any sort of legal case out of this one as well. I mean, everybody else is suing
everybody.
Maybe
they can't afford to.
And that's probably true, too. Oh, you know what? I bet you I know why. Duh, it was right in the first line. They're a Ukrainian studio. Probably very difficult for them to... I don't focus home. I don't know if they're a U.S. company.
That company is based on, is out of East Ukraine, and they're getting caught up in the little skirmish that's going on there. That's what that issue is.
Yeah, like, they can't sue anybody because...
The Americans.
They can't sue people because, unfortunately, their tank right outside office makes it very difficult to sue anybody. You understand.
That window.
Vladimir Putin has gun pointed that studio. Can't sue anybody. Sorry. All right,
thing like a horse.
Yeah, that's my very, very bad Ukrainian accent that probably just pissed off everybody that is east of Germany. You're welcome.
We would like to apologize to all Eastern Europeans and Western Northern Asians.
You know what? We'd just like to apologize to the entire continents of Europe and Asia. In any case.
Oh, that's an SNL.
Yeah, you just. I love that delayed time bomb on there when he.
Asia's continent.
Here's your audio daily double. Name this continent. Asia. I don't know. Could you repeat it? Asia. Anyway, jokes aside. So do you guys see any way of somebody avoiding this in the future? Like does this seem like this is just pretty much a nobody wins situation?
They can the dev can prep and set up their own store and have it ready. However, it is still going to be a bit of a no-win scenario other than having the store ready for a takeover. However, being able to announce it ahead of time or sim ship on two different listings within the same distributor, one that's going to be complicated and confusing for the consumer, or, you know, not necessarily complicated for the dev, confusing for the consumer. But on top of that, they're probably contractually obligated to only allow shipping through the publisher until the publisher terminates that contract or whoever terminates the contract. So all they can do is they can't warn people ahead of time if they've got no warning or if they're not allowed to warn people. So all they can do is set up the store and have it ready and hope that people remember the name of the game and search for it independently instead of just looking at their wish listing.
Yeah. About the best they can do.
Yeah. I concur.
Yeah. Unfortunate. Huh. On a positive note, at least the games should be back soon. So everybody will be able to get their Sherlock Holmes games back. And that's obviously extremely important, allegedly. I can't confirm nor deny the importance of that. On a final note, as we are now over time, you know, it's weird. It's weird how less distracted I get nowadays. In any case,
Kev's not here.
It's not Kev's fault. I just have my...
It's not Kev's fault. It's the fault of Loot Box!
Yeah. No, what it's really the fault of is I just haven't answered my phone that's been ringing this whole time.
Really?
What's funny is I hear the first part of that, and that's the ringtone I set up as my business line. So whenever I hear the classic phone ringer.
Yes, I have one of those really obnoxious Halloween things that makes a noise and annoys everybody. Got it? Because it's a skull phone. It's got a skull on the dial. And it's an old school rotary dial, so pretty much everybody under the age of 25 has no idea how to use it. That's my favorite part.
Hey, I know how to rotary phone.
Everybody under the age of 25 does not know how to use it because they were born in the age of pressing the buttons on the phone. What is that nonsense?
There was a discussion I was having with somebody. It's like, what will kids of this generation not understand? It's like the pain of misdialing a number on a rotary phone.
Oh, gosh, yeah, because it's hang up the phone, pick up the phone, start all over. And, yeah, because it's literally like you're...
In speed dialing, force you to turn faster.
There's no speed dial on a rotary phone.
Well, no, because it dials back at a certain speed now. But when you got the pulsed signal,
yeah,
you were actually able to force it to go faster because it was already sending out that signal while it was dialing back. But when it required the timing of it dialing back, which is before our time, you couldn't speed dial it, or else you'd screw it up.
Yeah. But it's the thing is, though, is it's still, I love the classic styling of it. It is it's my special friend, and I very much enjoy it. It's super nice.
Mort's just a giant play baby.
Yep.
I want to see you send a text message through that.
I'm gonna send you guys a text. Hold on. This might take me a couple hours to type this out here.
We need you to dial out a cat gif.
That's an even better one. How do you do a gif on a rotary phone? That is going to be the question. Well, that's of the thing. Year.
It's like, computer language, you have two options. You've got the much more difficult binary or the still difficult hex, but neither one of them is a standard 10-digit decimal.
Yeah. Didn't think about that.
Send it out in a string of ones and zeros. 40 years later, you finally finish the picture.
Anyway, so I'm done playing around because I'm going to literally.
No, you're not.
I'm just on the stream. I'm done playing around with that. After the stream, I'll of course torture these guys for another hour, just randomly picking up and setting down the phone. Fortunately enough, the viewers don't have to worry about that. I'm very polite to them, at least. Not the other podcast knows.
I don't have to worry about that because I am getting right off today.
I'll send her random messages of just, I'm going to record clips of that and just send it to her spammer constantly. So you just get out that over and over again. Yeah, that's the right way to do it, guys.
He's going to tweet it. And he's going to tag me in it. So,
yep. Always, that's the way I'm going to do it.
Hotkey the mute.
Yep. No, can't do it. So, in any case, we're going to get winded down here for the night, guys. Obviously, if this is your first time tuning in, we do stream every Saturday night at 7 p.m. Pacific. We do an alternating stream schedule where 1 week we do a podcast like what you're watching and/or listening to right now. In the off week, we actually get together and we stream some PvE games, some co-op stuff, which is good fun. Right now, currently in the month of October, we are just getting ready to start our Killing Floor 2 awesomeness. They recently launched their Halloween event. I can't remember the name of it. Rose posted up a video about it, and I've completely forgotten about it at this point. But
did I?
I think so. Somebody did. Whatever. Point is that they have a Halloween event that's awesome. And that looks like good fun. So we'll be getting to that next week. But also, if you want to listen to the podcast while you're sitting in rush hour or while you're sitting in bed or while you're otherwise indisposed in places not your bed or your car, you can also find us on pretty much every major podcast source that you might want to listen to on. Just search for The Pixel Crashers. Pretty simple, pretty easy. In any case, if you want to also follow us on social media, you can find us, you can find Lila Rose at Lila Rose, that's LILAHROSE. You can find Xiphened at Xiphened Up, that's XAIPHENEDUP. And you can find me at Mortiel, that's at MORTIEL, because I like to keep things simple and short. You can also see all the random tweets and nonsense. Xiphened is a master of dad jokes, Rose is a master of very complicated technical tweets, and I mix things up between ranting about...
I've gone a little beyond dad jokes. You know, I just have to state this importance right here. Don't ask questions, just eat insects.
Oh my.
I can't help it that I get overtly technical.
Yeah, that's the
God damn it, I need a 360 character limit and not 240.
I go between infinite.
No limit.
Retweeting cute animal gifs because that's super awesome. And then I also occasionally will rant about consumer advocacy stuff and argue with people, I guess.
And skulls. Don't forget the skulls.
That's my Instagram. My Instagram, of course, is the same thing, but instead of Mortiel with an O, it's Mortiel with a zero instead of the O. And yeah, that's where I post all my cute bunny photos and all of my skull photos, because I am now developing an insurmountable collection of skulls throughout my office here. I have a feeling that I'm going to be in here one day recording this podcast and you're just going to see me disappear and you're not going to know what happens. Well, that's because the skulls have risen up and taken over. And that is going to be the
end. I think it's
going to
be the bunnies. They've already tried to eat your electronics before.
That's just one of the bunnies. Very soon, though, there will be a swarm of bunnies, and then Mistletoe will have her army, and then we will all fear for our lives.
Here's the best quote for it. Death awaits you all with big, nasty, pointy teeth.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, guys, we're going to get signed off here for the night. We love y'all. We'll be back next Saturday. I hope it's next Saturday at 7 p.m. Pacific, in which case... we will have fun, we'll play some games, it'll be good fun, and hopefully everything works as intended. But that's the rest of the story, as Xiphened would say. Allegedly.
And now you've seen the rest of the podcast. Ah, shit. 42?
Yes.